We are talking with Father Mark Begley, the pastor of our Mother of Sorrows Catholic Church and St. Michael's Catholic Church in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. This is week 5 of the message series for Easter, the Eucharist, the Gospel of John. Welcome, Father Mark.
Thank you. It's good to be here once again.
Well, Father Mark, jumping right in there and getting right directly to the point, this is our 5th session, the Eucharist, and I know it kind of ties in from last week, conversion and baptism and the Eucharist, and maybe you could introduce that before we get into the meat of our discussion here today.
Right. Last week we talked about conversion and baptism, and again, in the Gospel of John, the public ministry of Jesus really is the developmental growth of the Christian in their spiritual life. And last week we talked about conversion and baptism. This week, in this famous chapter 6, this is a very important text. This has puzzled many theologians over the course of the years as to about the Eucharist and about the real presence of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist. And many theologians, especially the likes of Scott Hahn, it was this chapter that struck him so deeply as a Presbyterian, and eventually he made his way into the church because of his study of this famous chapter 6, which is on the Eucharist.
Well, Father Mark, as you have kindly done in previous sessions, you've given me some phrases, some sentences to key discussion. So we'll continue with that with that process. It's worked well for us. Where are we to buy bread for these people to eat?
That is in the very beginning of chapter 6. And again, this chapter is going to grow and develop as Jesus as John gradually gets to the actual understanding and talking about the Eucharist. But here in the beginning, we are talking about the multiplication of the loaves and fishes. And the interesting thing about this here is how it has these kind of Eucharistic notations attached to it. For example, there's a reference in the Gospel of John to the Passover, Passover being something that's very Eucharistic. Secondly, the gestures of Jesus are very similar to that of a priest celebrating the liturgy of the Eucharist. And finally, and this is very interesting, John draws a sharp contrast between the bread that was first available and the bread that was multiplied. He makes a point to say it was barley bread. Now, this bread is the bread of the poor, and probably you and I wouldn't even consider eating it. It was so difficult and harsh to eat. But the bread that was left over wasn't just this barley bread. It was somehow this bread that people would want, and they did want it. And so they saved it because it was great bread. And so not only was it the multiplication of the loaves and fishes, but the bread itself actually changed. And so this is kind of a Eucharistic precursor here of what we're eventually going to be getting to toward the end of this chapter.
A bit of a surprise, which we should expect from our God, right?
Yes, yes. And from this this author, this strange author.
It is I. Do not be afraid.
So the multiplication of loaves and fishes occur. The disciples go on their boat to go to the other shore. Jesus goes off into the mountains to pray for a while. And there's a storm that occurs on the sea while the disciples are there. And all of a sudden, here comes Jesus walking toward them on the water. And he says, "It is I. Do not be afraid." Kind of a weak translation, maybe I could say, of the I am that God said to Moses when Moses asked him his name. And maybe the better translation would be to say, "I am here. Do not be afraid." And so when he gets to the boat, all of a sudden the winds and the rain calms down. And so here, again, as we're gradually slowly making our way to the Eucharist, we see the action of Jesus, the action of God, which was kind of like Jesus or God acted in the Exodus when he delivered the Hebrew slaves from their chaos and their hopelessness. So here he is. he delivers the disciples in the boat from their chaos and from their hopelessness. So again, this is a way of us gradually, slowly getting to the point of what the Eucharist really is.
This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent.
If you remember last time about baptism, Jesus actually was talking about baptism. John was talking about baptism oftentimes without even talking about water. And this is kind of similar to that. This means that we have to believe in Jesus first, and not merely just to believe that he died and he rose from the dead. If I could say it this way, the devil believed in that. But actually, to authentic faith that we're being called to hear, to recognize the reality of the Eucharist, is this faith that changes us and transforms us and makes us to seek to be more Christ-like. So what he's saying here is you have to believe in me first before the Eucharist begins to make sense. You can eat the Eucharist over and over again and be untouched until one really believes in this Jesus Christ who has come to us and personally wants to be in a relationship with us.
Actually makes quite simple sense whenever you really think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Not complicated at all. Sometimes we have a tendency to complicate things.
Yes, we do.
I am the bread of life.
Now, this is probably one of the most important sentences in this chapter 6. And I want to say maybe four different things about this. Number one, you will see the crowd ignores that Jesus has said about faith. They want stuff. They want miraculous signs. They want the bread. They want the good stuff, not personal conversion. And in one sense, who can blame them? They were poor folks. So they wanted the bread. But Jesus keeps pushing them further to having a relationship with him. Secondly, he's not referring to his body and blood here in the Eucharist. Not yet. He's still referring to himself. He's referring to himself and not the sacrament. Here, it's about Jesus as the one who will reveal to us divine revelation, tell us the way to the Father. He's really talking about himself here. And finally, the reason Jesus moves his discourse about the Eucharist to this chapter 6 and away from the Last Supper is precisely so that he can introduce it with this discussion of this need for faith, just like he did in baptism. Before we can receive the Eucharist fruitfully, we have to have this relationship with Jesus. He himself is the bread of life.
Once again, the relationship with Jesus is the most important part of understanding your faith.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's the kerygma. We need to be evangelized before we can be catechized.
Is not this Jesus whose father and mother we know?
So they begin to wonder, well, who is this Jesus person? He's revealing himself, but who is he? And we know his father and mother. We know this guy. Didn't seem all that spectacular after all. And with this, I'd like to go back once again to the qualities of discipleship we talked about last week. First of all, personal experience is more trustworthy than provincial prejudice. I mean, they know his father and mother, so what? But their experience is that Jesus is different than what they might think he was. And number two, they have to trust their intuition. Jesus has done some rather remarkable things. They have to trust that, even though they know where he came from. And also, too, God is always surprising us. God almost never does things as we expect. So while they think they can reduce Jesus to being like everybody else because they know his mother and father, he's still quite special, and they have to open themselves up to that surprise that Jesus wants to offer them.
And the funny thing about the surprise, I've experienced it myself, and usually the surprise is for your own personal good, even though it may not be exactly the way you thought things would work out in your life.
Even better than we could have imagined oftentimes, yes.
The best way to put it.
Right.
Moving on, the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh.
Okay, now we're finally starting to talk about the Eucharist for the first time. The body and blood of Jesus are truly present in the Eucharist, but there is also this challenge. There is this danger, and John is about this all the way through his gospel. We can reverently receive the Eucharist, perhaps with great scrupulosity sometimes, but neglect its meaning in my life. John is greatly concerned about us receiving the Eucharist without this personal relationship with Jesus. But now he is beginning to talk about the Eucharist in a way that began to baffle his listeners.
Baffle?
We're going to see that as things unfold. I mean, puzzle, baffle, all kinds of things.
I'll take your word for it. Those who eat my flesh and drink my blood abide in me and I in them.
We can go back a couple weeks. There's that word abide again that you emphasized. Remain in me. Stay with me. We talked about that last week. This was the same word that was used in John chapter 15 about the vine and the branches. So he's saying that our receiving the Eucharist helps us to really have this intimacy with him. We begin to live the same divine life he shares with the Heavenly Father. It is a deep, intimate communion. And here, we were saying before about God's big surprises for us. I don't know how we can read the Gospel of John without seeing over and over again this intimacy that Jesus wants us to have with him, and also this intimacy he wants us to have with his Father. It's just everywhere. And here we go again, this abiding, staying with, and beginning to live the same divine life he shares with his Father.
This is a difficult teaching. Who can accept it?
I was reading a couple commentaries on this one, and we think it's about the Eucharist. That's the difficult teaching, but really, it's about Jesus himself. Everything he's taught. This whole teaching about himself being the bread of life, himself being the way of the Father, himself revealing the Father, the Eucharist included, all of these things are very difficult for them to accept. So it's the whole comprehensive understanding of Jesus that we've been reading all the way through the idea of conversion and baptism and now the Eucharist. So all of this has them, I guess, puzzled and baffled again and wondering what is really going on here.
Lord, to whom shall we go?
Which are the words that Peter said. So I guess we could imagine ourselves there. And so Jesus turns to the apostles and says, and by the way, right before this, a whole bunch of people left him. A lot of his disciples left. So he turns to the disciples or the apostles and says, are you going to leave me too? And Peter says, where are we going to go? You have the words of everlasting life. So not exactly the ringing endorsement I'm sure Jesus was hoping for. But basically what Peter is saying, if we could find a better gig, maybe we would go. But we can't find anything better than you right now. Now, we'll see things much more differently later on. But that's, I guess, the best they have to offer at this point.
And Jesus was thinking, you got to have something better than that, right? Never has anyone spoken like this.
Okay, here we go. This is the only really quote we have from chapter 7, which really is a continuation of chapter 6, which is a great big controversy about who Jesus is. They're arguing back and forth at who he is. The chief priests, the elders, the people themselves. Jesus goes up to the festival to be there with them, shows his impatience with the people for not getting who he is. And here at this point, the chief priests and the elders are telling the temple guards to go arrest Jesus. Go get him and bring him to us. And they go and they come back empty-handed. And they say, why did you bring back Jesus? And he says, well, nobody's ever spoken like this guy. He's different. There's something remarkable about him. At least these temple guards kind of saw that. And so here are the elders and the chief priests of the temple who don't see the wonder of these guards, and they don't see the surprising, wonderful thing that's happening before their very eyes. And this is the tragedy of chapter 7, which is a continuation of what's going on in chapter 6. So the tragedy here is they cannot allow themselves to be open to Jesus, even though the guards are in awe of him and say that no one has ever spoken like this guy before.
based on the thought you just shared, Father Mark, it would probably be a good idea maybe if we reviewed those qualities of discipleship that we've talked about through the course of our discussion, because it seems very appropriate, because some guards found him to be surprising and wonderful, but people who may be more educated or more learned did not.
Yeah, or the leadership, the ones in control, the whole power group were not able to. And so you wonder, whenever people get into situations of authority, if they no longer yearn for the meaning of life, they kind of get comfortable with where they are. But so to be able to be in wonder about Jesus, somewhere along the way, you have to be seeking God, seeking the meaning of your life. And then to make this commitment, this firm commitment to stay with Jesus through thick and thin. And as we could see, a lot of them didn't stick with Jesus through thick and thin. And then thirdly, trusting your intuition. I mean, he was doing remarkable things. The multiplication of the loaves and fishes, walking on water. But then they go back and they start talking about, well, we know where he came from. And allowing themselves to be open to surprise. And then finally, allowing their personal experience to be more trustworthy than their provincial prejudice that seemed to stop them at every turn. And I think it stops us sometimes too. I think we could really say this chapter 7 is a chapter that takes us back to John's community and how they, proclaiming that Jesus Christ was divine, was frustrating their Jewish neighbors because of their appreciation of the divinity of Jesus and the presence of the Spirit they thought was among them. And their Jewish neighbors were just so incredibly frustrated with the early church and the Johannine community for thinking that God's Spirit was with them. And I think chapter 7 really is almost autobiographical of their community and their experience, more so maybe even than something that happened to Jesus. And they place it in the context of Jesus' public ministry, in this context here in his gospel.
Well, Father Mark, as we delved into chapter 7, I know that you want to make a reference to chapter 8 as it relates to our discussion today.
Right. We're including the beginning of chapter 8 in this week's scriptures because we don't know where else to put it. The story that we're going to include is a very popular story that many people are aware of called the story of the adulterous woman, where Jesus is writing on the ground, where Jesus says, those of you that have not sinned, throw the first stone, and how he engages this adulterous woman. And once he engages her, he tells her not to sin anymore because he doesn't condemn her. But the whole point here is that this doesn't really seem to be part of the corpus of the Gospel of John. In later editions of the Gospel, all of a sudden it seemed to appear. There are some theologians who believe it belongs with the Gospel of Luke as opposed to the Gospel of John. So really, in our discussion of the four stages, it doesn't really seem to fit. But we're going to throw it in here toward the end of this particular section, only because it kind of seems to follow next. But I guess I want to say that while we're going to show that video of this on Wednesday night, and we're going to talk about this a little bit, it really isn't part of this part of John. And in saying that, I'm not saying it's not a part of divine scripture. I'm just simply saying it seemed to have gotten lost someplace. Nobody knew quite where to put it, and they put it here. And nobody seems to understand why.
I take your word for that, okay. Father Mark. Okay. Father Mark, thank you for sharing your knowledge and thoughts as they relate to the Gospel of John.
You're welcome. It's always an honor.